I'm Father Mitch Pacman. Welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. And today I would also like to invite you to help me celebrate the feast of St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of my order, the Society of Jesus, and seek his intercession for us all to seek to serve Christ our King. 45 years ago, our guest that we're having here tonight was invited by the Chinese government to be the first American social scientist to visit the mainland. He was a first-hand witness to China's then new one-child policy. Now, if you fast forward from then to 2024, where Xi Jinping has picked up where Chairman Mao Zedong left off by exerting communism's influence over the people through various forms of thought control and certainly by hatred of God and all religion. He details the totalitarian rule that the Chinese people suffer under today in his new book, The Devil and Communist China, from Mao down to Xi. So please welcome the president of the Population Research Institute, Mr. Stephen Mosher.
Stephen,
thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks now, for having me.
You were the first social scientist invited by the Chinese to go to mainland China, you know, since communism had taken over in 1949. Mm-hmm. Year of my birth, I had nothing to do with it. It's not my fault. But why were you chosen of all people? What was your connection that they said, oh yeah, we want Steve Mosher to come over here?
Well, they didn't really want me to come over.
Oh yes?
But they wanted American scientists to come over. They wanted our engineers, they wanted our scientists, they wanted our computer engineers, our nuclear physicists, and so forth. So they signed a scholarly exchange agreement with the United States.
Yeah.
Under the terms of which we were to send 50 people over to China, and they were able to send thousands of people over to the United States. Very fair and balanced program, right? And of the 50,
Who was the negotiator?
This was under President Carter. So okay. If you're looking, you know, the buck stops there. So there was only one social scientist picked among the 49. The rest were all, you know, physicists, engineers. China welcomed them. The only one whose proposal was turned down was mine, because I was an anthropologist from Stanford University, and I can read, write, and speak Chinese. And they didn't want an inquisitive social scientist wandering about the country asking questions of ordinary people that the Communist Party would not be able to monitor and control. Mm-hmm. So they said no initially, and it was only after former President Jimmy Carter had a meeting with Deng Xiaoping, China's then leader. And Jimmy Carter said, you know, we have this American social scientist from Stanford who'd like to go to China. And Deng Xiaoping, who wanted American technology, wanted American financing, wanted access to the American market to help China develop, said, oh, it'll be no problem. Well, guess what? When the dictator of China says it won't be a problem, all problems disappear.
Yes.
Everybody,
so
the door was open.
People.
So I was welcome to China and spent a year there and was able to find out an enormous number of things about life after 30 years behind the bamboo curtain. And it was not all pretty, Father.
No. I actually knew a priest, he's passed away now, but he was arrested under Mao Zedong when they started to arrest the missionaries. Mm-hmm. He was in a prison for 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And made to sit in a cell in solitary for hours a day, meditating on his sins of being a capitalist.
Yeah.
He's got his own, Father Houle, mm-hmm. Jesuit from California province.
Yeah.
Marvelous man. But no, it was truly horrible.
Mao hated religion, and he hated Catholicism in particular because he thought that missionaries were representatives of the imperialistic West. And they weren't, they were there to save souls.
Right.
Right, they were there to convert the Chinese people, something we failed to do over the last 2,000 years, mm-hmm. To our discredit. But Mao would say things like, missionaries are Nazis, missionaries are terrorists. And even during the days of the revolution back in the 1930s and 40s, the first thing that would happen when he would move into a new village, he'd take over the church. Catholic church was the best built building in the village. He would steal all the vessels, anything of value. He would send the missionary away, and that would be his campaign headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Something about his hatred of religion that I didn't know much about his life. I started studying a little bit more about China to prepare for this program because that had not been part of my curriculum in the past. But you brought out a number of points regarding Mao's early life and how his mother had, he had the name Mao Zedong from his family and then the name they gave him. And Zedong means what again in Chinese?
Zedong means light of the East, which is very curious in light of all the darkness that he brought to China and all the death and destruction. But his mother wasn't satisfied with that. When he was a young boy, she took him out to a stone god, a monolith, about 8 feet high outside the village. And she dedicated him. She rebaptized him. She made him kneel on the ground.
Well, and he wasn't really baptized, but it was
no, he wasn't baptized. Dedication. I mean, it was a kind of pseudo-baptism, a false baptism. And she gave him a new name. And the new name she gave him was Third Son of the Monolith, which is to say third son of the stone god that he's kneeling before and kowtowing before. This little boy had to beat his head on the ground 9 times in the traditional kowtow. And after that, he was thought to be under the protection of that monolith. Mm-hmm. And he was very proud of that name, oddly so. You know, he would often refer to himself as the third son of the monolith. And he grew up into a man who had a heart of stone. So the whole thing, you know, you wonder if that false baptism, that false rechristening, had opened him up to demonic influence.
Because demonic he became, I mean, one of the points you make about Mao Zedong is that he was the worst, the most serious mass killer in the history of the human race.
Yeah, by far, no comparison.
I mean, we think of Hitler's being bad, where 10 million people were killed in concentration camps altogether. Stalin was far worse at 61.9, but Mao Zedong was even worse than that.
Mao's whole life was one long killing spree, Father. It started during the Revolutionary War, when his troops would invest a city, preventing food from going in and people from going out and starve hundreds of thousands of people to death, quite deliberately, to weaken the nationalists. It continued after he seized power. Mm-hmm. He would persecute one group after another. He started with anyone associated with the nationalist regime. They were all persecuted. Many were executed on the spot. Then he went after the so-called capitalists. Anybody who had a business, anybody who had a factory was targeted. Struggle, these were public criticism sessions that often resulted in the person being struggled, being beaten to death, or later executed. Death by a thousand cuts, by the way, is a real thing. Torture by slicing off people's flesh piece by piece. And then he moved to the landlords, we think of landlords, someone who owns 1,000 acres. These were people in China who owned a little more than they could themselves farm, and so they would lease out a couple of acres. Mm-hmm. And the landlords would kill 10 million of them in the early 1950s. And then we go to the Great Leap Forward, when he forced China's hundreds of millions of villagers into huge communes. Well, a lot of the villagers didn't want to go. They wanted to keep their land. They wanted to keep their family farms. There were millions killed of those who objected to joining the commune system.
But even when they joined the commune in the Great Leap Forward, and part of what he was trying to do was have people learn how to smelt iron ore. And they did it so poorly that it was useless. But they couldn't grow their own food. They were trying to smelt iron and not plant any crops.
Well, imagine taking 10 villages with a total population of, say, 30,000 people and putting a Communist Party official in charge of farming that area in absolute control over the villagers in that area. A Communist Party official who was very good at quoting the quotations of Chairman Mao, but knew nothing about farming, when to plant, when to fertilize, when to harvest. It was a disaster, absolute disaster. And mass famine followed. And one of the things they did during the Great Leap Forward was Chairman Mao said, we're going to catch up to England in steel production in 3 years. And so all across the country in these new communes, everyone started being ordered to build backyard smelters. They would build them out of brick. They would cut down trees. 10% of all the trees in China got cut down during this period of time and fed into these furnaces. That was in lieu of coal. They didn't have access to coal. Where did they get the iron ore? They didn't have iron ore. So the villagers were told to bring in anything of iron, their plows, their woks, their cook pots, and put it in the furnace so it could be melted down into ingots. And these ingots could be given as an offering to the local Communist Party official to show that, yes, now we produced steel. Well, it wasn't steel. It was useless. Pig iron had to be re-smelted. But that was a sort of diversion of resources, misuse of resources, human resources, physical resources, that resulted in the worst famine in human history, beginning in 1960 and running to 1962. 45 million people in China starved to death. Entire villages died, Father. There are villages that no longer exist in China because every living soul in that village starved to death in the early 1960s.
And one of the lines that Mao used is to turn those people into fertilizer. That, you know, he would want people to be just used to fertilize the soil.
Well, this shows you how heartless he was.
Exactly.
Because here you've got the leader of a country, and you've got hundreds of millions of people famished, you know, starving to death, and tens of millions actually dying. And what did Mao do? Did he sympathize with them? No. He said, it's good that they die because their bodies will fertilize the soil. He thought of human beings as nothing more than human compost. And then he said, you know, if there's a food shortage, it's better that half the population dies so the rest of the population could eat their fill.
Yes. And he said that more than once. It wasn't just an offhand remark, like in a political campaign.
His associates came to him and said, you know, people are hungry. And Mao said, let them eat grass and tree bark. He was heartless. He had a heart of stone. Remember, he was the third son of the monolith.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the way that the cruelty, when you take all the people that he starved to death in those 2 years or so of the Great Leap Forward, and all the folks that he killed during the Civil War and the revolution in against the nationalists, who were they're supposed to be helping the nationalists fight the Japanese invaders, but that's not at all what he did.
No, he sat back and let the nationalists do all the heavy lifting in terms of fighting the Japanese invaders, while he built up his base areas, while he inducted all the men in the villages he was conquering into the Red Army, while he was getting support every month from Joseph Stalin in terms of money and arms and supplies. He was waiting for the end of World War II so that he could have an army that he could use to attack the nationalists, win the Civil War, and conquer all of China, and he did. So when Prime Minister Tanaka of Japan came in 1972 for the first visit since World War II of a Japanese leader to China, he met with Mao. And the first thing Tanaka did was he said, you know, I'm so sorry for our invasion. And Mao laughed and said, don't apologize. If you hadn't invaded China, the Communist Party would not be in control of the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Japanese Imperial Army was itself extraordinarily cruel to the Chinese people, but not nearly as cruel as the Communist Party led by Mao Zedong.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of the number of people killed, the Nanjing Massacre, that famous period of where 300,000 civilians in the capital, then capital of China, were killed by the Japanese, 300,000. Mao, over the course of his long and bloody career, left a trail of death of probably 100 million people. Yeah. And then after his death, of course, when I was in China, what started happening? The one-child policy, which added greatly to that death toll.
In, as I mentioned in the beginning, you were there when the one-child policy started. Why did they start a one-child policy in China?
It's a long story, but the Club of Rome, which is a Masonic group in Rome, Italy, had commissioned a study about overpopulation.
I read that back in the 60s.
Yes, we all read it.
Yes.
And we were told that we're going to run out of zinc and chromium and oil and petroleum products by the 1990s. And the only thing we had, what we had to do to avoid economic and social disaster was control the population, reduce the population growth rate.
They took a staunchly Malthusian approach.
Absolutely.
They had to reduce population. War is good for you. It kills people off and makes more.
So the leader of China, Deng Xiaoping, the same guy who let me go to China, heard about the study and decided that China was going to emulate the West because this was the latest and greatest of Western science, supposedly. It wasn't. It was a fraud. Mm-hmm. But they implemented the policy with an idea that they were going to reduce China's population to 600 million. That was going to be the carrying capacity of China. Mm-hmm. And in order to get there, they imposed a one-child policy. In 1980, it ran until 2016. And under that one-child policy, I was living in a Chinese village when the local Communist Party secretary came over to my house. It was March 8th of 1980, and he had in his hand a new Communist Party directive. He said, "I thought you'd like to see this new directive." Well, of course, I wanted to see all the directives I could. And it said that the population of this province was growing too quickly, and women were not going to be allowed to have more than one child. I said, "Well, how are you going to enforce this?" He said, "We're going to do a house-to-house search of the village. All women who are pregnant with second, third, and fourth higher-order children are going to be told they must get an abortion." And that's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. They arrested these women for the crime of being pregnant. It had been legal to have more than one child, and now it was suddenly illegal, ex post facto. And these women were arrested, taken away from their homes and families. They were locked up and subjected to morning-to-night study sessions at which they were told they had no choice, but they must go in and get abortions for the good of the state, for the good of the party, for their own good, for the good of China's future. And one by one, all these poor weeping women, most of them were in their early 20s, late 20s, were taken in under guard, under escort by Communist Party officials, and they were given abortions. I went with them when they went into the clinic. I was there when they were doing forced sterilizations and forced abortions on women who were 7, 8, and 9 months pregnant. They were doing them by cesarean section abortion. And I had been at Stanford University, Father. I had thought, because Paul Ehrlich was a colleague of mine at Stanford University, the author of,
The
Population Bomb. Mm-hmm. I thought that when I went to China thinking that China may be overpopulated, I went to China thinking that maybe overpopulation was a thing. And then I saw the forced abortion of women who were 7, 8, 9 months pregnant. I saw the killing of innocents who, with moderate care, could survive at 7, 8, 9 months if they were born early. And I realized this was wrong. It was as if the pit of hell had opened up before me. This was a great evil.
Yes.
And it convinced me of two things. One, it convinced me of the existence of God, because if such a great evil can exist, there must be a compensating good, and if you seek the good, you'll be led to God, who's the source of all goodness.
Were you not a Catholic at that time?
I was worse than being not a Catholic. I was not a believer. I was an agnostic at best, a practical atheist, as we say. Mm-hmm. I'd been at Stanford University, one of the high temples of secular humanism. The Christian faith is not respected there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in 1980. It's even more disrespected today. And I went to China, believe it or not, thinking that the revolution had done good things for the Chinese people. I had been at Stanford with people like Professor John Gurley, who wrote books celebrating Mao's revolution. I was at Stanford with people like Professor Donald Harris, Vice President Harris's father, who was also an economist, a great admirer of Marx and Lenin and Mao. And so I went thinking that the Communist Party had done good things for the Chinese people. It took the Chinese people a year to convince me it wasn't so, mm-hmm. that the Communist Party had not improved their lives. In many ways, it had made their lives worse. And then, of course, I was in the operating room when they were killing innocents at birth, and I became pro-life. Mm-hmm. It was clear to me what an abortion was. How could it not be clear? It was happening right in front of me. They were killing little daughters of Eve, little sons of Adam.
Yeah. And one one of the things that, as that policy developed, Chinese people began getting ultrasounds or other indicators of gender. And when they would find out they had conceived a girl baby, that they would target those for abortion more than if it was a boy baby. If you only have one child, I understand that in Chinese society, your son has the responsibility to take care of you along with the help of his wife.
So there's a preference for sons to carry on the family name and to take care of the elderly parents when they grow old. Daughters marry out. They don't stay with the parents to support them. They're required to support their husband's family. And so there's a preference for sons. You combine that with a one-child policy. When I was in China, little girls started being killed shortly after birth, female infanticide. Mm-hmm. A few years later, ultrasound machines moved the point of death from after birth to before birth because we began to have sex selection abortion. There are 60 million women in China missing because they were killed before or after birth as a result of the one-child policy between 1980 and 2016.
But it's not only that these 60 million women are missing. It also means that there are 60 million men for whom there is no woman to marry. That's just a flat reality.
It is. There are 60 million young men, middle-aged men now, who will never be able to marry because the women they would have married were killed decades ago. That's one reason why we have higher rates of prostitution in China now, higher rates of gang activity. It's one reason why we see the People's Liberation Army growing because young men are available to join the military in large numbers. It's one reason we see sex trafficking of women in China, not just in China, but across borders from North Korea, from Vietnam, from Burma, women being sold to the highest bidder in China, sold into brothels, sexual slavery, or sold to a man to be his wife. So there are all sorts of consequences that follow from this.
Yeah, in the world today, there are about 45 to 48 million people who are essentially sexual slaves. And the largest number of them is in China.
Yeah.
Because they...
Because of the one-child policy, the distortion of the sex ratio, the overabundance of men, the shortage of women. So it's had all kinds of social consequences. But the other point to make here, though, is this, that the Chinese Communist Party, communism always has to have a target. It has to have a group of people. It calls them counter-revolutionaries. It calls them enemies of the state. It always has to have a group of people to target for a campaign of hate to distract the people from the righteous anger they feel about the abuse of the Communist Party, their own abuse that they suffer at the hands of the Communist Party. And in the early days, it was the capitalists, it was the landlords, right? It was the rightists. Beginning in 1980, for the first time in human history, the enemies of the state became, for the first time in communist history, unborn children. And for 36 years, unborn children were the enemies of the state, declared by the Chinese Communist Party to be the enemies of everything that was good, to be the enemies of China's future, to be the enemies of the future happiness of the Chinese people. Can you imagine that? Turning the Chinese people against their most valuable possessions, their children. 400 million babies were killed during this Holocaust. And if you add that 400 million to the 100 million that Mao killed, that's a total death toll of about 500 million, a half billion people, unimaginably large number.
Yeah. I've talked a number of times over my years of being here about the 20th century being the most violent century in the history of the human race.
Yes.
After the second to the 20th century is the 13th, with Genghis Khan and the Mongolian horde killing about 50 million people. And then third would be Tamerlane coming also from South Central Asia. But the 50 million is horrible. In the 20th century, it was, apart from abortion, It was 305 million people died in war and genocide and political persecution. It's absolutely astounding. And when you add the abortion to it, it's an incredible total. I mean, our total is huge.
Yeah, and sadly.
And grievously so. But this is even far worse, multiple of 6.5 times.
Chinese Communist Party is the biggest killing machine in human history. But it's a logical outcome of communism, which does not respect the dignity of the individual, does not respect the worth of individual human beings, thinks of people as a mass, thinks of people as the masses, and eliminates them, wantonly eliminates them whenever they get in the way of this the communist project. The interesting thing about the Chinese Communist Party is that it acknowledges that its own history and its own ideology is a fabrication. Because it said a few years ago that an accurate account of the history of the Chinese Communist Party, which means the history of the killing spree that we've been talking about, would be a threat to continued communist rule in China. And an accurate account of the ideology of China would be a threat to Communist Party rule, because the ideology, you see, is a fantasy. The government is never going to fade away. Chinese Communist Party leaders are never going to stop expropriating the wealth of the masses and becoming filthy rich in the process. It's all a fabrication intended to deceive the masses.
And something I mentioned, in fact, in my sermon this morning, is that we need, you know, St. Ignatius of Loyola, whose feast is today, has a meditation in the second week of the exercises on the two standards, the standard of Christ. Now, kings would have these standards, and you rally to the standard, you rally to the flag. That's where you know where your army is. And capturing the enemy's flag is always a goal of armies. The flag of Christ is the cross, and he's the king of the new and heavenly Jerusalem. And he rules by humility and by his gentleness and primarily by his love. And he brings a peace to our hearts. He says in John 14, my peace I give you, my peace I leave you, not as the world gives do I give. His peace lasts. The standard of Satan is that of the horrible Babylon in the book of Revelation. And what Christ says characterizes Satan in John 8 is that he's a liar, the father of lies, and a murderer from the beginning. And the last thing I always like to add about Satan is what happens after Saint Michael defeated Satan in Revelation. Now is the accuser of our brethren fallen, he who accuses them day and night. He always wants to bring us into sin, and then he says, see, you did it, you did it, you did it. If he, when he's not using lies and not using death. And everything about Marxism is to associates with those characteristics of Satan: lies, deceit, and the bringing of mass murder. More than the National Socialists were absolutely horrendous. There's nothing that was good about, but this is socialism of another order, and it's even more deceptive than Hitler and more destructive. I think when you look at this history, you need to see this. This is the kingdom of Satan.
Yes.
It has all of his marks.
It absolutely.
Whereas Christ has another mark. And that's why they hate Christ and must drive the church out.
Well, this is why I wrote the book. You see, I went to China from Stanford University, and I had been taught that socialism, communism was a good thing. And I found out from personal experience, at the hands of talking to hundreds, if not thousands, of Chinese, that it wasn't so. I found out about the mass murder, the forced abortions, the killings. And so I had this understanding that you now possess and that you now just shared with the audience. But I wanted to share it with the younger generation because 45 years ago, the academics at Stanford were leftist. But those views have now percolated down to high school and junior high school levels.
Absolutely.
You have civics teachers in high school and history teachers and social science teachers in junior high school who believe that communism was a good thing,
mm-hmm.
that it's a great system, it's just never been really tried.
Mm-hmm.
Those students need to know the truth about the lies and the deceit.
Exactly.
Mao was a perfect son of Satan. When he faced a choice of achieving an end by telling the truth or by telling a lie, he chose to tell a lie because he could achieve his end and then count himself clever in the process. He always chose evil.
And he said that about himself.
Yes. He said, I am Wu Fa Wu Tian, which means I am without law and without God. I think he got that in reverse because he should have said, I'm without God and without law, because if you reject God, then you reject the natural law that's written in the human heart.
Yep.
He also said, in great chaos, there's great political opportunity. He was a chaos agent. He wanted to destroy
exactly.
society. He
exactly.
wanted to set groups one against the other. He wanted to launch campaigns that would target and kill and extinguish specific groups because that was his modus operandi. And he did it over and over and over again. Communist parties always need a target for their hate.
They need a target for their hate, and they all have the same anarchist belief that if I can just get rid of the present order, I am able to rebuild it the way that I want, and I will make the perfect society. It's truly living out better to rule in hell than serve in heaven. We have to take a break, but we're going to come back. And by the way, if you are interested in finding out more about Stephen's work, you can go to the Population Research Institute, which is pop.org, P-O-P.org, and you can find out more there. All right? We'll be back in a couple of minutes with your questions and comments, so please stay with us. Welcome back. We are discussing a really fine book. I found it very, very informative. It's called The Devil and Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi, by Stephen Mosher, our guest. It is item number 26501, 26501, at our EWTN religious catalog. You can go to EWTNRC.com. And you can order it there. It's well worth it, well worth it. And I recommend it very highly myself. You ready for some questions?
I am.
Let's start off with Thomas in Tennessee. He's way up there near Rocky Top. Thomas, what you got?
How you doing, Father?
Better for talking to you.
That's great. Well, I wanted to ask you, in your homily this morning, you mentioned the miracle, Fatima's miracle of the sun, and that 11 days later was the Bolshevik Revolution. And, of course, we all know the role that Fatima played in communist Russia. My question is to Mr. Mosher, Professor Mosher, is did Fatima or does Fatima play a role in communist China?
Okay.
Well, that's a very interesting question because I think that Russia, of course, was supposed to spread its errors throughout the world, and it did successfully spread its errors to China.
Yes.
You see, China would not have won the Communist Party led by Mao Zedong, the Red Army, would not have won the Chinese Civil War without help from the Soviet Union. What kind of help? Well, in the last 90 days of World War II, the Soviet Union moved into Manchuria, took over the entire Japanese army in Manchuria, several hundred thousand men, and all their arms and equipment, the howitzers, the gunboats, the planes, the tanks, and everything, and handed all that over to Mao's Red Army. There were Japanese trainers training Mao's Red Army, and added to that were 200,000 North Korean communists who also joined Mao's forces. So for the first time, thanks to help from the Soviet Union and Stalin, Mao had command of a first-class army against the nationalists who'd been fighting for the last 7 years against the Japanese. And that made the difference in the Civil War. So Russia did spread its errors to China. And China went on to spread its errors to other countries, to North Korea, of course, which is still communist today, one of the worst brutal totalitarian dictatorships in the world under the Kim dynasty. It spread communism to Vietnam, where China had 300,000 troops in North Vietnam fighting on the side of the North Vietnamese during the Vietnamese conflict. They spread to Cambodia and encouraged Pol Pot. Pol Pot was an avid follower of Mao Zedong, killed off 25% of the Cambodian population under the Khmer Rouge. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're now spreading their errors through Africa, encouraging tyranny, encouraging despotism wherever they go. The main supporter in Venezuela of Maduro is communist China. We know the Venezuelan people would like to throw out dictator Maduro. They voted for that end. But China is supporting Maduro, encouraging him to stay in place. So Fatima still comes true through China.
And they have this well-known Belt and Road policy.
The Belt and Road Initiative.
They go all over the world to poor countries, helping them build roads and such, but they send a lot of Chinese workers to help do the work there, and they can marry people in those countries because they have no women back home. And they also put these countries into debt to China.
Yeah.
And then they can have a big influence through the debt control as well.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the help, okay? It's not really help because let's say that China in the Belt and Road Initiative, which they did, went into Kenya and said, we're going to build a road from Mombasa, the port, to the capital. Well, they built a road and a train line from connecting those two cities, the two major cities in Kenya. China loaned Kenya the money to build this, but then said, you have to pay us back the money because we're going to send our own construction battalions to build the road and the train line. And then we're going to send our engineers to run the train. We're not going to translate the manual into English so that only our technicians and our engineers can service and keep the trains running. And finally, because the train is running at a loss and you can't afford to pay us back for the loan, the train is going to become ours. That's what they do. They will build a port, and then when the poor country can't pay back the loan, China takes over the port.
Yep.
And they own a port.
Yep.
Or they own a railroad. So that's kind of help that the Communist Party is giving people. Yep. It's a debt trap.
It reminds me of the way the old coal companies would have a company store. They'd pay you in scrip, and then you stayed in debt to the company store to buy food. And you only got paid in scrip, not in cash, or you could go anywhere else. And they just kept you basically on a certain form of indentured servitude. Well, they're doing this to whole countries.
They're doing it to entire countries. And no continent has suffered more than the continent of Africa.
And one of the reasons they seek Africa out is they're looking for rare minerals. And the child labor that's being forced in Congo and elsewhere.
In Congo, you got 8-10-year-old children digging into earthen banks for lithium ore, which is being shipped and refined in China, not in the Congo where it would provide jobs, but it's being shipped in container ships to China, where it's being processed into lithium batteries to run electric vehicles. But the child labor is awful, and the deaths that result, the collapse of these poorly constructed mines onto the heads of the people digging in them. It's not just child labor. It violates every labor law known to man.
Yeah.
But the Chinese Communist Party does not care about human beings. It does not care about human suffering or human loss. It is only interested in power and profit.
Yep. We have a question from our studio audience. Sir, where are you from?
From Louisiana.
Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what is your question or comment?
Well, Professor, based on your research and findings in China, and given the social and the cultural trends that we have currently and political trends that we have in America, what are the odds, what are the chances that America could devolve into a society like China did in such a short time?
Well, that is exactly China's hope, of course. That's why China is so active here on so many fronts. We have a huge increase in the number of Chinese nationals crossing our southern border. Many of them are military-age males.
As a matter of fact, I think there is a hotel in Mexico where for Chinese people where they rest up before they cross into our border.
More than one. The numbers have gone up spectacularly over the last couple of years. And I think the Chinese Communist Party would be foolish not to put in this flow of migrants, many of whom are economic migrants, let's be clear, put in spies, put in saboteurs, put in potential terrorists. That's one thing. The other thing is TikTok. TikTok is a social media app that a lot of kids are on that is run effectively by China. And one American parents need to know that while on TikTok you can see every perversity known to man, in China, the Chinese version of TikTok, it encourages young people in China to study hard, to stay in school, to do science experiments at home, to read books, and they don't have allow the kinds of things that they promote in the United States. So there's those kinds of things are happening. And you also have, for the last two generations, you have young Americans who are not being taught the principles of limited government. They're not being taught about the American Constitution, the rule of law, separation of powers. They're being taught that socialism slash communism is actually a good system of government. They're being taught to admire regimes like Castro's in Cuba and even Mao's in China. They're not taught the truth about these systems. And so they can be easily misled. Our questioner has raised a question that I worry about. We have lots of young people in the United States who, because they're poorly taught, are listening to the siren song of communism and perhaps voting for people who would move us in that direction.
Yeah. No, I think one of the small positive side effects of COVID is that parents began to see
yes.
what was actually being taught to students. And that wasn't what they learned. You know, and it wasn't a love of America, it wasn't mm-hmm. a love of freedom, wasn't a patriotic goal, but it was a criticism of America, often by a communist mm-hmm. who, you know, wrote a People's History of America.
Right.
And it is as deceptive as anything that comes from Marx. If you ever read that book, or you find your students are reading it, you ought to take a look at it. And there's, I forget her name right now, but she wrote a refutation part by part of that book, A mm-hmm. People's History, because it's just distorted and lies.
It's a fabrication. It's yep. a history of the United States told from a Marxist perspective. But, I mean, look, this is why I wrote the book, because so many young people have been miseducated. And I think a lot of the people watching will know that communism is evil. If they lived through the 60s, 70s, and even 80s, they saw the collapse of communism mm-hmm. in the Soviet Union. They know that Eastern Europe is now free where it was once enslaved. But people who grew up after that, the millennials, the Generation Zs, they're the ones who need to read this book. We've done in Florida, where I live part of the year, passed a law mandating that schools in Florida at the junior and senior high school level teach the truth about communism.
Mm-hmm.
And this book will be part of that curriculum.
Yeah.
I've helped to put together a curriculum at the Voice of Victims of Communism Memorial in Washington, D.C., a nationwide curriculum to teach communism as it really is, the death toll, the torture, the human rights abuses, the lack of freedom, the violation of religious believers' freedom of conscience, all of these things.
Absolutely. We have another caller. This is Lawrence in the great state of New Mexico. Lawrence, what can we do for you today?
Thank you, Father Mpakwa. This is a question for Mr. Mosier. There is a concord with China that was negotiated by Cardinals McCarrick and Parolin. It's been renewed three times, and I've read and we don't know what's in it. And I've read three different sources that says that the Communist Party is paying the Vatican $2 billion per year. I want to know if there's any validity to this story.
Thank you. Thank you, Lawrence.
Let me say first that the Chinese Communist Party spreads corruption everywhere. And they use three principal means. They use honeypots, they use drugs, and they use money. So they are paying off officials in governments all around the world. They spread corruption everywhere because their system is corrupt. All of the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party are billionaires. I mean, literally billionaires. And you can, if you tell me the position that a Communist Party official in China holds, I can tell you how much their net worth is going to be, because a county official is going to be worth $10 million. A prefectural official, $50 million, a provincial official, $100 million. You can almost guess how much money they've been able to extract from the people in terms of corruption. Yep. So this is their standard way of operating. Now, I read the same stories that our caller read, and I called Cardinal George Pell. We lost him now, of course. He's gone to his reward.
Yes.
He was a friend of mine. I went to Australia many times, met him there.
Good
and
man.
I asked him, because he had been in charge of Vatican finances for several years, I said, is there any evidence of payments coming in from the Chinese Communist Party and its entities? And he said to me, there's nothing on the books, Steve. He said, but I don't have access to the personal accounts. Now, you can make of that what you will. I'm just telling you that how the Chinese Communist Party behaves and would behave, and what Cardinal Pell told me. I pray that it's not so. I pray that no one in the Vatican would be taking money from this corrupt enterprise, which is responsible for the ongoing persecution of the Catholic Church in China.
Yeah, and the persecution is very real.
It is.
And it gets increasingly bitter. You know, again, I mentioned Father Houle, who was in prison. One of my favorite stories from him is that his mother sent him a care package, and in it she sent Necco candies. You're old enough to remember Neccos.
Yes, I remember Neccos.
Those chocolate wafers. Yeah. She put a host in between each candy. And sent him a bottle of wine disguised as medicine, and he was able to celebrate Mass. You know, but he had to do stuff like that. But this was it was just horrible persecution of the church and of the Falun Gong, a type of Buddhist sect. All these, you know, they hate
all
God
religions.
And religion.
All religions, absolutely.
But they, again, Catholicism in particular. Let's go to another call. You have David in the great state of Ohio. David, what can we do for you?
Thank you for taking my call, Father. It's the age-old question. How does God work through all of this atrocities? I mean, the millions and millions of children that have been aborted, to the wars, to the Holocaust. I mean, where is God through all of this? It seems like God is distant. God lets us take care of what's happening and stands back.
Do you want to address that?
Well, I'm a Catholic convert. I came into the church on a beautiful spring day in April of 1991, and it was in part a result of my experience in China, witnessing the horrific forced abortions of young women and the deaths of babies. And I believe my conversion in part came about because of the communion of saints. I believe that those babies whose deaths I witnessed, I've been speaking out for them in a very weak human way for decades, and I think they've been interceding for me in a very powerful supernatural way before the throne of God. So, and I agonize over the fact that our Lord suffered and died and was buried and was resurrected almost 2 millennia ago, and much of the world still remains unconverted. Mm-hmm. There's some evidence that Christianity reached China during the latter Han Dynasty in the 2nd century AD.
Right.
There's more evidence of the Nestorian Christians in China during the Tang Dynasty, archaeological evidence. But and the Dominicans and the Jesuits tried, but China remains unconverted. And I just have to think if we were praying harder and working harder, that God would intervene and stop what's happening. But you're the theologian, Father, so I defer to you.
Let me give a response, because I've thought much about this in a lot of ways. I knew two of my cousins who survived the Nazi concentration camps, and I knew other people who had survived, and talked to them, Jewish and Christian alike. And, you know, in as well as having been to Poland in communist times and then after. And there are a couple things. You have to pay attention to the way that evil does this destruction, but it also self-destructs. We were talking earlier today that when the Lord was exercising the demoniac, the Gerasene demoniac, and the demons said they were a legion, and they said, don't send us to our place. They don't want to go to hell. They don't like it either. And he said, send us into those pigs. And he gave them leave, and then they destroyed the pigs. And this is one of the things to keep in mind. All of these evil enterprises are as self-destructive as those demons that went into the pigs. China is destroying itself by, I'll be dead most likely, but by 2060, the United States will have a larger population than China.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way the statistics are working.
Mm-hmm.
And they're destroying themselves. The Nazis destroyed themselves. Germany suffered horribly as a result of that war and experienced tremendous destruction. And the Soviets brought terrible destruction to themselves. They are like the demons killing their own pigs, and they drive themselves over. But it's not just that they are self-destructive. Think of the greatest generation that stood up to National Socialism and the way that the Germans were trying to destroy Europe and the Empire of Japan destroy Asia. That greatest generation stood up, suffered much, and overcame it. We also saw, after much prayer, the Lord raised up Pope St. John Paul, along with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and brought down Marxism. It was falling apart for a lot of reasons of its own, but they were also used, along with Lech Wałęsa and so many others, that God can also raise up. And in the face of so much evil, we either become very evil with it, or we become very good against it. And in the face of great evil, the devil would tempt us and accuse us and everybody else to give up and lose hope. Whereas Scripture tells us that hope saves us. And it's hope not in our ability, but in God. I don't see where God is acting exactly. That's something that's beyond me. But I try to pay attention to not fall into the temptations and instead say, Lord, what are the graces you are giving me to push back on evil? We overcame the empire, the Roman Empire, the various other empires in history, the communists, the Nazis, and the Lord can use us again. This is what we depend on. Again, I recommend you read The Devil and Communist China. Get that from our religious catalog. Stephen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Father.
And may the Lord bless all of you and keep you by the intercession of St. Ignatius Loyola, inspire you to serve God. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Amen. And again, we can bring you this show and all of our shows only because this program is brought to you by you. Please keep us in between your gas bill, electric bill, and cable bill, and we'll be able to pay all of our bills too. Thank you for your support, and God bless you all.